We're talking about COVID testing on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the Harvard Health blog this month, it says there are hundreds of COVID diagnostic tests that have been granted emergency use authorization through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. But it's not exactly clear how accurate any of these tests are. Some reassurance, though, on the PCR test, the false positive rate should be close to zero, meaning it would be rare for your test results to say you have COVID when you don't. Bring on COVID test questions. Molecular tests, also known as PCR, antibody tests, antigen tests, 800-642-1234. Dave O'Connor is the UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here with you, Kate.
Well, let's start with PCR tests, better understanding them. This is what UW-Madison is rolling out through a saliva-based testing program that will start with a spring semester starting Monday. First, let me run through all the disclosures. WPR is a service of UW-Madison, which means I'm a UW-Madison employee, which means I participate in the testing program since I come to campus, which means I tested on campus yesterday, and when I woke up this morning, my Safer Badger app had turned green. Green is go. I don't know, Dave, have I missed any disclosures here?
Well, for my part, I'm also a UW-Madison employee, though I have no role in the Safer Badgers program. I haven't been involved in it at all.
Okay. So can you explain then the molecular PCR test, its pros and cons?
Well, the molecular tests, these so-called PCR tests, have become the gold standard because they are tests that are very, very sensitive at picking up even trace amounts of virus. And that can be really good for identifying which people have any amount of virus in their system. And so if you're really trying to find as many people as possible who are infected, PCR is the most sensitive way to go. One of the things you have to consider is what the goal of your testing program is. Is it to find people who have trace amounts of virus who are not necessarily going to transmit the virus to others? Or is it to try to identify the people who are most contagious? So when you talk about there being hundreds of different tests, those different tests can have different purposes. Some, to try to find as many people as you can who have any virus at all in their systems. Others, like the so-called antigen tests, are better at finding people who are likely contagious and are the most likely to transmit the virus to others.
Is there a gold standard yet, a gold standard test?
Well, there is no one test that satisfies every possible combination. So the PCR is the gold standard for picking up the smallest amounts of virus with the greatest sensitivity. But in some cases, that might be counterproductive because if someone has a trace amount of virus that is detectable by PCR, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have enough virus or that they're coughing or expelling enough virus that they can infect other people. So you need to match the test to what you're hoping the testing program is going to accomplish.
Well, let's say a testing program wants to accomplish finding all the asymptomatic people. It sounds like there are different thresholds of being asymptomatic.
Sure. So there are. So if you think about the biology of an infection, as soon as you're infected, there's going to be a period where there's a tiny, tiny amount of virus that eventually becomes a huge amount of virus. And that small amount of virus becomes a large amount of virus really quickly, say in 24 hours. So there, it really is good to have the most sensitive test if you're trying to find all of those people right as their viral shedding is starting to take off. But then you have the issue that after people have gone through this peak window of contagiousness and the amount of virus is tailing off, well, now you're back down to a place where only the PCR tests are going to test positive. But at that point, a PCR test isn't going to tell you very much about contagiousness, even after you've had symptoms. So again, it's complex and it's difficult. And for asymptomatics, I think the best thing we can do is to think that testing is one piece of a very large puzzle. But the biggest thing is that we need to take other measures and assume that people are infected, because if someone's asymptomatic, it's going to be really, really hard to catch them with any sort of reliability.
Okay, so taking other measures, meaning still wear the mask, still social distance, still wash your hands a lot.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Dave O'Connor, an infectious disease researcher at UW-Madison, where his lab focuses on viral infections impacting human health. He's been working on COVID testing as well. You can join in with your questions about the various tests. Have you ever had a rapid COVID test done? How long did it take for you to get results? What were the results? 800-642-1234. Dave, take us into these rapid COVID tests. Also, the antigen test. How does this rapid test compare to others?
Yeah, this is where we're really excited and have been spending most of our time. So you asked earlier about asymptomatic transmission. That accounts for about 50% of infections. People who are newly symptomatic account for the other 50% of infections. And these antigen tests, which cost $5 compared to the $100 for a PCR test, and take 15 minutes to give results instead of hours to days, can pick up those 50% of infections caused by people who are symptomatic really, really well. And so we've been working over the last several months to make it possible for K-12 schools in Dane County to run antigen tests on site. So if a teacher or a student develops symptoms while they're at school, a school nurse or someone else in the school who's trained can run an antigen test and in 15 minutes can determine whether or not an individual's symptoms are due to COVID.
Okay, and so then you can run the interference very quickly because time is really important here.
Right, because the window where someone is contagious is really short. If you can find out within the first 24 hours of someone developing symptoms that they're infected, then that individual and their family and their household contacts can take the sort of precautions necessary to stop transmission from occurring. One of the things we know about the virus is that 10% or so of people who are infected account for about 80% of the transmission. And that's because when you have these people who are in this contagiousness window, they're really, really likely to spread the virus to others. And so if you can intercept them in that window, that's where you're going to have the biggest bang for your buck.
What do you see in terms of the reception from schools? Are you able to get these into the schools? What is the status of that?
So we were lucky in November. We received an allocation of 5,000 of what are called BNACs now antigen tests from the Department of Health and Human Services. And we've been able to bring those into Dane County schools, with more than 80 schools now each receiving one box of these tests that they can use on symptomatic people in their school communities. And we've worked with them to get the regulatory approvals. We've worked with Public Health Madison Dane County to make sure that all the schools are following the same best practices. And now that we have all of these schools that are running these tests successfully and have this capability, we're working with the Department of Health Services, who are working with us to get an additional allocation of about 50,000 tests that we hope to be able to bring to the schools over the next several months, so that each school in Dane County that's part of this program can run these tests reliably through the rest of the school year. And then if that works well, hopefully this sort of testing in Dane County can be a model for other places in the state.
UW Pathology and Laboratory Medicine Professor Dave O'Connor breaking down testing for COVID, where we stand. Have you been able to find local testing when you need it? Did you order an at-home test from DHS? Did you understand the type of COVID test you were receiving, you were taking? Have you had a false negative test, or have you had to retest if your specimen wasn't acceptable? Bring your questions, your situation on testing, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dave O'Connor here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about COVID tests here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison anticipates it will administer up to 70,000 saliva tests each week on the campus testing program. COVID testing requirements get underway with the spring semester that starts Monday. Are you taking regular COVID tests at home or through your workplace or school? How is it going? What questions do you have about those tests? Join in 800-642-1234. UW School of Medicine and Public Health Pathology Professor Dave O'Connor is our guide with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jackie now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Jackie. What is your question?
Hi. I guess it's more of a comment than anything. First of all, I want to appreciate you having the speaker on this morning to give this information. I just kind of want maybe he could elaborate a little bit. There's been a lot of misinformation or people misunderstanding about what the different tests mean. There's doctors and school districts around an area that I'm aware of that are saying that the quick test is just as effective or in telling whether somebody has COVID or not. We have people running in to get tests when they're not necessarily symptomatic and thinking that they're okay. So just wanted to pass that along because I think there is a lot of education that needs to be done about these different tests.
Jackie, thank you. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And it is hard to understand because it's true that a large number of infections, about half, happen when people are asymptomatic. So some amount of testing for people who are asymptomatic makes sense because that does account for about half the infections. However, you need to test a huge number of people, as you described for the UW-Madison testing program, in order to find the needle in a haystack, that person who feels fine and is infected. Whereas with the symptomatic testing, your yield is going to be a lot better, because the other half of transmissions are in people who already feel sick. And so the presence of symptoms is an indication for the value of testing. And because you do have this really short couple of day window when you're most likely to transmit the virus, that's where we really have to be focusing our attention, in my opinion, if we want to use testing to slow the spread of the virus, is stopping transmission more than finding every last person who might have a trace amount of virus in their system.
Has the cost of these test kits come down through the pandemic? Because we're talking about, you know, so many more tests in individual campuses and workplaces. What are the costs?
Well, yeah, so the PCR tests still remain very expensive. So Medicare reimburses these at $110 per test. And so there's a really entrenched interest now for the companies and the, you know, providers of these PCR tests to perform them at $110 a piece. I don't know what the cost of the at-scale tests are for a program like Safer Badgers, but I know that other similar programs do PCR tests that are more economical in the $30 to $40 per test range. But that still is a lot more expensive than the rapid antigen test that I was talking about before the break, where they're $5 per test.
What about the supply chain here? Do we have enough reagents? Do we have enough of those little vials and tops and all of the things that you need in order to actually do these tests?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because there's been so many different institutions and universities and places performing tests, the little plastic pieces that we need to do all kinds of biomedical research are in really short supply. And so that has been a real challenge. Fortunately, some of the other types of tests, like the antigen tests, are self-contained and don't require any sort of specialized equipment or plasticware.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with UW-Madison pathology professor Dave O'Connor, and he is talking with us about COVID testing, the various tests, and what he is working on. Have you had trouble accessing a COVID test where you live? Tell us what issues you've had. Did you have the virus but were asymptomatic? When were you tested? How has that affected your life? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dan wrote a comment on WPR. Dan says, if expensive at-home self-administered antigen tests had not been blocked by the FDA, we could have a 30-pack in our medicine chest right now. And Dan thinks PCR tests haven't done enough to control the virus. Can you comment at all on that?
Yeah, so I'd thank Dan for that comment because I think that speaks very much to the same sort of strategy that we're trying to use in schools, that democratizing and decentralizing testing is really important. If you can do that at home for $5, that would be even better than having to do it in schools. But being able to do it in schools and having hundreds or thousands of schools being able to perform testing on people who are symptomatic is better, in my opinion, than the sort of centralized testing we have today. So we're making steps in the right direction, but it has been a real challenge to get testing where it can be most useful.
Okay, what about specimen here? Is there a difference between getting a throat swab, a nasal swab, or a saliva sample?
So there are differences, but they're really on the margins. So those brain ticklers that were that people dread that they got early in the epidemic are still the absolute best. But we know that the simple ones where you stick a Q-tip up your nose a little bit until it's uncomfortable, or if you spit or drool, that there is enough virus in there that is assuming you're infected and have a reasonable amount of virus shedding, you're going to pick it up in any of the specimen types.
Let's talk about mutation and this virus. We knew of a variant and found it in Wisconsin, B117. What do you see about mutations now as you study COVID?
Yeah, so my lab, along with other UW-Madison investigator Tom Friedrich, have been doing a lot of the genomic surveillance for these variants in Dane County and with our partners in the city of Milwaukee. And we haven't seen them in Dane County or Milwaukee yet, but it probably is just a matter of time. It's really important that we look for these variants as well as other variants that are going to continue to arise because there's the possibility that some of these variants could be more transmissible, which is what we see with this so-called B117 variant. And it's also possible that some of these variants could make it difficult for diagnostic tests to perform appropriately, for therapeutics to work as well. And some of them could conceivably, though there's no evidence for this yet, impact the effectiveness of vaccines. So we really need to be watchful over what the variants are and where and when they're occurring. They will occur, but we just need to we need to have eyes on that.
Let's bring in Mark now in Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Way back in the spring, BBC Science in Action program reported a feces test that anybody can do themselves, a stool test. And I guess, I don't know if it's a test paper that turns color or something. And it only costs $1. And, other countries, must be testing more broadly with something like this to get it under control.
Mark, thanks. Are you aware, Dave, of this particular test?
So one of the things that we saw early on is that some people do shed virus in their feces, not as much as you see in saliva or nasal swabs, but enough that you can use wastewater as a way of determining how much virus is in the community. So the individual feces tests have not really taken off, but what has been really useful is taking the wastewater where all that feces is collected and then sampling that for the presence of virus and then measuring how much virus is there to say, okay, there's growing amounts of virus in all of the wastewater or the amount of virus is going down in the wastewater, and using that as a way of determining what the trajectory of the virus is within a community. So it has been useful, but more in that community surveillance capacity.
Yeah, so a snapshot of a fuller area and looking at it through time too, I would imagine that would kind of help you understand whether the virus is spreading or not, but in a very much more of an a snapshot of a whole area.
Absolutely.
So as we start to wrap up here, what are you as a scientist working on next with COVID testing?
Well, the biggest thing in terms of testing is this implementation lift of trying to make sure that schools can run antigen tests on symptomatic members of their community, working with the state to be able to get more of these tests so that it becomes less of a barrier for participating schools to get testing. You also have to realize that a lot of the existing testing can be inaccessible to people who have transportation barriers or can't make it to test sites for scheduled appointments or during the hours that they're open. And so making it so that people who are symptomatic can get tests easily, can get those results, and that close contacts can take precautions is really where we think you're going to see big improvements. And we're really delighted that the state's working with us to make it possible to figure out how these programs can work best.
Dave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Dave O'Connor is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Ahead this hour, on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we discuss what abortion and reproductive health might look like under the new Biden administration. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about an historical football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up. And all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe it, 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville Four-Wheeler Drive Truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage with coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing football net, but it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds, like sometimes 3,000 people at that game, because, you know, years ago, there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering. You know, it's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just, this is history that people should know.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we look at what President Biden may do with Trump-era policies on abortion, contraception, and reproductive health. Dr. Anthony Fauci, Biden's chief medical advisor, announced in a speech to the World Health Organization yesterday that Biden will repeal anti-abortion restrictions on American aid in the coming days, known as the Mexico City Rule. What policy reversals are you watching for? What about the prospects for the Hyde Amendment? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law. She is the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, here we are talking about Roe on the 48th anniversary. You've looked so closely at what we mean when we talk about the Roe decision, and in some ways, how the original Roe decision is long gone. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that we just use Roe to mean very different things. So, for example, President Biden on the campaign trail vowed to codify Roe or make Roe the law of the land, as he put it. And that really sparked a debate about what he meant. So Mike Pence, for example, said that meant he wanted abortion until birth, and pro-choice leaders pushed back and said, of course, that's not what Roe v. Wade means. So to begin with, we use Roe to symbolize lots of different things. But even on the legal plane, the Supreme Court has already dialed back legal protections without officially overturning Roe. So now it's a lot easier for states to pass abortion restrictions that will be upheld than it would have been in 1973.
These are the thousands of cuts that you often write about, talk about. And, you know, you've studied how anti-abortion leaders try to get around the idea of respect for court precedent and this patchwork of laws governing abortion around the country. Do you see that changing at all over the next 4 years?
It's hard to say, right? I mean, there's been some sign with a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court majority that we might move beyond the death of thousand cuts approach into something more aggressive or absolute, right? So something that looks much closer to a direct overturning of Roe in the next few years. I think that's a little bit less likely, in part because of President Biden and this election and the fact that the Democrats control the Senate, because there are at least potential consequences to a really aggressive court action like that. We've seen discussion of, for example, the Democrats changing the size or composition of the Supreme Court. I don't see that happening necessarily, but if the court were, for example, to overrule Roe in June, I think that would become a lot more likely. That kind of decision would be very controversial. So I think the fact that the Senate is in Democratic hands makes a death of a thousand cuts approach more likely.
You know, earlier on in the pandemic, we saw some states try to limit abortions by labeling them as an elective surgery. Is this still happening? What is the state of abortions right now during the pandemic?
Well, we haven't seen as much of that, in part because the states that were moving to treat abortions as unessential medical procedures were also the states that were essentially opposed to lockdown orders and mask ordinances. And so since most of those mostly red states are now completely open, and it's harder, obviously, to justify banning abortions as unessential medical procedures when you're allowing every medical procedure, essential or not, to go forward. What we've seen instead recently is that the Supreme Court has reinstated requirement for abortion medication. Now, what that means in practical terms is that for women who are seeking, or pregnant people generally seeking, early abortions, they can often in the first 10 weeks use abortion pills to have those procedures, and a lot of patients prefer that. And now again, the FDA once again is requiring that you actually go in person to pick up a pill, even though you can take the pill at home. That had been blocked for a while because of the pandemic. The Supreme Court just reinstated the requirement, so that'll make it harder for people to have early trimester abortions without face-to-face contact.
Yeah, and so that's the FDA versus American College of OBGYNs. That decision was handed down mm-hmm. this month. Is that indicative at all, a sign at all, about where the high court is headed on this issue?
It definitely could be. I think the reason for that in part is because this decision didn't really need to happen. So the court had sort of sat on this case for 6 months, what looked like kind of waiting for it to go away. And now it would have gone away, right? The Biden administration will likely change the FDA. A Biden administration FDA will likely eliminate this in-person requirement. So if the court just didn't want to get into this at all, they probably could have waited and the case would have vanished. So the fact that the court reached out and decided this anyway looks like a court that's interested in taking on the abortion issue and rolling back abortion rights.
We're discussing reproductive policy and what the new Biden administration will do in the first 100 days. Abortion is arguably the most divisive issue in U.S. politics. What are you watching for out of the Biden administration? What do you think about Biden planning to repeal the Mexico City rule that bans foreign non-governmental organizations from performing or promoting abortions as a condition of receiving U.S. aid? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mary Ziegler here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Florida State Law Professor Mary Ziegler. Her legal scholarship is at the intersection of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. President Biden was sworn in as a U.S. senator in 1973, the very year Roe v. Wade made abortion a constitutional right, 48 years ago today. We're examining what reproductive policy could look like in the Biden administration and where Roe stands today. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Mary, let's look at the Mexico City rule for a moment. President Biden plans to reverse this policy. First, explain for us what this rule is.
So this rule deals with abortion counseling and services abroad. So it's often referred to, it's actually unfortunately one of several things referred to as a gag rule. Essentially, it blocks U.S. federal funding for any organization that provides abortion counseling or referrals or performs abortion services or even advocates to decriminalize abortion. So in practical terms, you would imagine that organizations like Planned Parenthood abroad are prohibited from receiving U.S. foreign aid to do any of those things, but also from receiving aid at all, given that they essentially advocate for abortion rights. So there's been a kind of ping pong effect with the Mexico City policy going back to Ronald Reagan, where you see anti-abortion GOP administrations imposing the Mexico City policy and Democratic pro-choice administrations reversing that step. So this isn't anything new. I think what we're more curious to see with the Biden administration is if we see kind of new steps on abortion, for example, like the elimination of the Hyde Amendment. That would be much more striking.
Yeah, I thought that's exactly where I thought you might be headed with the Hyde Amendment, barring federal funding for most abortions, which Biden has flipped back and forth with here. Can you explain the Hyde Amendment, where it stands, and what the Biden administration may do?
Sure. The Hyde Amendment is a ban on Medicaid reimbursement for abortion. So in practical terms, that means that patients who are relying on Medicaid can't get Medicaid to cover their abortions. There are other ways that low-income women can try to get their abortions paid for, often through private kinds of nonprofits, but there is no federal governmental medical program that does that. And it's been part of appropriations bills, basically, usually for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. So every time there's an appropriation for that department, the Hyde Amendment's been attached to it. There's been a kind of bipartisan consensus going back some time in support of the Hyde Amendment, even among politicians who were nominally pro-choice, which was part of the reason why President Biden was at the time, I think, supportive of the Hyde Amendment. It wasn't at all unusual to be. But I think now, as the Democratic Party has become more progressive, and particularly on abortion rights, and particularly on what some of us would see as reproductive justice issues, issues that primarily affect low-income people, Biden has changed course and says he now opposes the Hyde Amendment. Now, whether he's actually, or I mean Democrats more broadly, are going to use political capital to eliminate the Hyde Amendment, given how many things there are on their agenda, is a different story, because we've seen before Democratic presidential administrations and Congresses that are committed in theory to ending the Hyde Amendment that don't make it a priority.
You know, what tops the Democratic agenda then when it comes to reproductive health, when it comes to contraception, and when it comes to abortion? What is at the top of the list?
Well, I think what probably is at the top of the list for the most part is still preserving Roe. I think there's been a kind of not necessarily healthy even obsession with keeping abortion legal. And I think there people have been kind of laser focused on the Supreme Court. The other question, I think, is if anything related to abortion is going to be a priority, because there are so many things that Democrats have kind of emerged from the Trump years seeing as deeply problematic, and some of them connected, of course, to the Capitol insurrection and people's belief that the election was stolen and so on. So there's no shortage of problems that Democrats want to tackle. And for the Hyde Amendment to go would likely be controversial, especially given that Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is, arguably kind of the most powerful man in the Senate now, has signaled that he is not necessarily in favor of eliminating the Hyde Amendment.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing how the Biden administration might approach reproductive health, contraception, abortion. Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University College of Law and a legal scholar in this area, taking your questions as well. What do you think about the legacy of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade? Where do you perceive our society's views on abortion now? How would you like to move forward from here? 800-642-1234. Mary, maybe the last time we talked was the Supreme Court had a major decision in June Medical Services versus Rousseau over the summer. Where does that blockbuster decision fit in the history of reproductive law in Roe? And that was the issue of, as you know, of course, the Louisiana law requiring abortion providers to get admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles.
Well, I think we're still waiting to see, because the precise meaning of June Medical is being contested in the courts as we speak. So as some listeners may remember, Chief Justice Roberts, in that opinion, seem to say that the rules that applied abortion restrictions were looser than they had been before. So in other words, it would be easier than it had been for states to pass abortion restrictions. Even though he didn't go all the way to overturning Roe, essentially he said states should get more deference than they have had when they want to restrict abortion. There's fights now about whether Roberts' opinion is actually controlling, right, whether that's the law or not. There are fights about what it means, but it seems to be the case in most lower courts that have the opportunity to think about this, that they're leaning towards saying that Roberts' opinion was in fact the law, and that June Medical represents kind of the first step on a path, or the first of several in this sort of death of a thousand cuts that we discussed.
Let's bring in John now in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi. Sorry to take my mask off so you can hear me. I just wondered if your guest could comment on Planned Parenthood v. Casey, because that's really as far as I understand it, that's more the precedent-setting case right now. and that imposed this undue burden standard has become such a mess, because how do you determine what is or is not an undue burden, and all these states requiring admitting procedures and stuff, closing down all the hospitals for abortions. And, you know, how do you clean that up?
The Casey decision from 1992, John is asking about.
Yeah, I mean, Casey is, of course, John is absolutely right that it's kind of the case we're talking about. So when we say overruling Roe, we're talking about what remains of Roe after Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And as John says, Casey preserved the idea of a right to choose abortion, but then changed the rules that apply and essentially said that only unduly burdensome abortion restrictions would be unconstitutional. And the problem, as John notes, is that the court has never been that clear as to what counts as an undue burden. Now, both sides at various points have benefited from that. Pro-choice forces have been able to convince the court at times that the undue burden test means a little more for abortion rights. And anti-abortion forces have benefited, too. I think there was a sense in which maybe the court could dial quite far back on abortion rights without officially overturning Roe and risking that kind of backlash. So that's still a possibility. I think there are conservatives on the court who would be at least a little intimidated by the prospect of political blowback, who might take advantage of the messiness that John describes and kind of use the undue burden test to give states more and more power to restrict abortion without really being clear about what's going on or confronting Roe directly. That said, I think there are more justices on the court now who want to say something direct about Roe and who will not be satisfied with that kind of covert route.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we'll see playing out in the next month is a sort of fight between these conservative factions on the court, in particular to kind of determine what some of these conservative justices we don't know as much about, like Justices Coney Barrett,
Amy
Kavanaugh,
Coney Barrett, mm-hmm.
Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch are going to do on abortion. We simply don't have enough data points, even though we can make pretty educated guesses. They haven't really said much or anything about abortion as Supreme Court justices.
Is there an appetite to take these cases on?
That's the thing we don't know. I mean, we have every reason to believe that these are conservative justices, right? There's not going to be a lot of deep conviction about abortion rights on this court. But that said, we don't know if there's an appetite for taking abortion cases, much less overturning Roe quickly. So we'll be waiting to see. Potentially, you know, in the next half an hour, the court is going to be issuing orders from its most recent conference. It's considering, among other things, a case from Mississippi that would ban all abortions at 15 weeks. You know, if the court took a case like that, it would tell us a lot about how eager these justices are to reverse Roe.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, as always. It's fun to come on.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she researches abortion law and reproductive history. Just ahead, we talk with a prominent American historian about what we can learn from the Civil War and what mistakes were made when the Union reformed. Fast forward to today, does our divided nation and concerns about the security of the Capitol echo the Civil War's early years? Let's discuss. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.